It's April, it's AZMcast, so many cool things going on this podcast. New stuff, old stuff, I got a new microphone, but there's no time to get into it right now. So let's get into it. Welcome to this month's episode of AZMcast. I'm just curious how many of you laugh when you hear me say AZMcast as if that's a real thing. I guess it kind of is a real thing. Anyway, aside from that, we've got a great episode this month. We've got the end of the pharmacy talks with Chris Edwards. He's going to talk to us about pressers, things that people have been asking about for months. We've also got our core content-ish lecture about the management of upper and lower GI bleeds, where Jared and I talk about bleeding from various orifices. There was a request to talk about efficiency. We're getting near the end of the year. The seniors are going on to greener pastures, and everybody's moving up a little bit. So we're going to give you our 2 cents on that. And lastly, but certainly not least, we're going to do a new segment. Who knows if it'll actually be a segment or just a one-time thing, called One Question with Peter Rosen. This is where I ask Peter Rosen one question, and he shares his vast experience and knowledge in the practice of emergency medicine. All in all, it should be great. I hope it's entertaining. I hope it's educational. And if you don't like it, the next podcast is going to have on loop Pharrell's Happy Song and the soundtrack from Frozen. I will do it. I will turn this podcast right around. To give you a brief refresher, we, meaning Jared Mosier and I, sat down with Chris Edwards and talked to him about a whole lot of pharmacy-related topics. We filmed this all at once and split it into little sections, kind of like Lord of the Rings. The other similarity is we actually flew to New Zealand in order to film this. It's kind of ridiculous, but luckily the department paid for it. Man, I love being an attending. Anyway, Chris is going to finish up talking about pressers. We hope you enjoy. So we talked a little bit about medications that'll make your blood pressure go down. Let's talk about the more common conundrum we get into is how do we get this person's blood pressure back up? I still have that little card on my ID badge right here that has all of those drips and all of the cool stuff, and I refer to them quite a bit because thankfully I don't have to put a whole lot of my kids on pressers, but when I'm in adult land, I go, oh yeah, that's right, I need to remember this stuff. So I know every scenario has its own indication. But here in the ED, what's our favorite presser that you guys have found?
It's got to be Levofed, norepinephrine. You know, anytime that you're going to start somebody on pressers, you want to take a look at what their vitals look like, what the patient looks like, and then pick an agent based on its pharmacologic properties. And, you know, in most of the situations that we run into, septic shock and things of that nature, neurogenic shock, norepinephrine tends to be the answer. So the nice thing about norepinephrine is that you have predominant alpha-1 activity, which is going to increase your systemic vascular resistance, right? It's going to cause them to clamp down. And it's not really going to affect their heart rate too much. Things like dopamine and epinephrine give you a lot of beta-1 effects, so you're going to see a big jump in their heart rate. So if you got somebody who's already tachycardic at baseline and hypotensive, like someone with septic shock, norepinephrine really starts looking attractive because it's going to increase their blood pressure without affecting their heart rate. What do you think, Jared?
Yeah, I think 90% of the time, maybe 99% of the time, Levofed's the right answer. I really think that it depends on two things. One, maybe three things. One, what's their underlying heart rate? Mm-hmm. Two, what's their heart look like on the ultrasound? And three, what's the physiology of their shock? So if you've got somebody in neurogenic shock from a spinal cord injury, maybe all you need is just phenylephrine. But if you look at, like, anaphylactic shock, you know, why don't we give phenylephrine to that patient? Well, two reasons. One, because it's only a partial agonist. And two, because it doesn't stabilize the mast cells, so we use epinephrine in that choice. If you had somebody who was in septic shock and their heart looks terrible on ultrasound, maybe epinephrine is the right choice. If you could use a lower dose epinephrine compared to Levofed, then you're adding vasopressin and all that stuff. But I think in general, 99% of the time, Levofed's the right choice. Dopamine, on the other hand, is dead. It's probably never the right choice.
Absolutely.
So as a counter to that, I always point out,
kids. I have to be the advocate. Someone please think of the children. Somebody. dopamine is actually the preferred vasopressor in children, and that's actually got evidence behind it. There was a head-to-head. This was years ago, but it was head-to-head, Libafed versus Dopa, and Dopa won out. So on kids, always got to be different. Don't throw Dopa completely out.
Yeah, it's direct opposite of the literature for adults.
Absolutely.
Dopamine versus Libafed, dopamine was clearly worse.
I got a great slide that has them on either side and say, just to confuse things even further,
so
they're exact opposite.
So what age would you switch?
I would usually switch somewhere. So what I like to do is use the PALS guidelines very, very roughly. So an infant is anything less than 1 year. A child is anything 1 year to axillary hair, breast development, pubic hair, something like that. Anything older than that is an adult. And that's usually somewhere between 1 to 12. So if you're less than 12, you're probably still a kid. If you're somewhere, if you're growing a mustache and you're shaving, and, you know, I'll do the... sometimes I do the underwear test. If you have Mickey Mouse or Dora the Explorer on your underwear, you're probably still a kid.
So the first thing Leech does in a patient who comes in shock is looks at their groin.
For a line and a pulse.
Right.
And while I'm there, I happen to look at those.
You asked three questions. Line, pulse, and pubic hair.
That's true. Oh, boy. Well, I'm going to... If anyone wants to take any of my North Pod shifts, because after this podcast is aired, I'm not going to be allowed to see children.
So...
Hey, Nick Stay, can I borrow your mustache?
I completely forgot. This was supposed to air during Mustache March. Nick, we missed the mustache, but we're glad that you're allowed to live in neighborhoods by schools again.
Let's talk for a minute about push-dose pressors, because I'm partially responsible for creating this monster of the fennel, the push-dose fennel. I've spent the last year trying to undo it.
Man, you are one pathetic loser.
So, if used correctly, in the right patient, at the right doses, it can be a useful tool. I used to carry around a stick of phenylephrine in my pocket, and then I switched from my lab coat to this black jacket and stopped doing that because I don't have the pocket space. But the trouble with the sticks of phenylephrine, a few things. One, it's really easy to inadvertently overdose somebody. They only need 1 mil out of that 10 mil syringe, and I've seen it happen a couple of times where the whole stick gets pushed, and I'm like, oh God, no! But you just can't stop it in time. So it's a serious med safety concern. And the other thing is, phenylephrine can cause reflex bradycardia, and I don't think that's something that most people think about. And the third thing, phenylephrine is usually not the pressor that the patient's going to end up on. Usually what I'll use it for is a temporizing measure. So what I've used phenylephrine for in the past is I'll throw the stick to whoever's taking care of the patient, say, here, give them 1 mil of this, I'll be right back with a Libafed drip. And it buys me that 3 to 5 minutes to go and compound the drip and get the pump set up and everything else.
Yeah, I think phenylephrine is for a couple things. One, this is push-dose phenylephrine. Mm-hmm. One is you're intubating somebody, and while transitioning them to positive pressure ventilation, let's say it's a COPD patient or something that needs to be intubated, you intubate them, even better, head injury patient.
Sure.
You intubate them, transitioning them to positive pressure ventilation, they drop their blood pressure because they have a drop in venous return, and you've given them a chemical sympathectomy from the etomidate. Phenylephrine for 10 minutes is not that big of a deal. It's probably the right thing to do.
True.
If you have vasodilation from etomidate, or if you have a drop in venous return from transitioning to positive pressure ventilation, phenylephrine might be the right choice for a push dose. Mm-hmm. Or let's say you have the A flutter that you're going to cardiovert and they're hypotensive and you're going to give them DILT or something. Maybe phenylephrine there for 10 minutes.
So we talked briefly about some of the other pressors. So norepinephrine, definitely the first line for most anything. That's the, I'm not really thinking about this, and the patient's hypotensive, so grab norepi, because you're going to be right 90% of the time.
Good
so feature. Other than anaphylaxis, where the treatment is epi, any other times you would reach for epi as a first line?
Yeah, there are some. If you need a push-dose pressor, and you don't have time to get Levofed on board and put in a central line before you intubate, I use epinephrine. And the reason is because phenylephrine, although it will give you a better blood pressure, will decrease your venous return because it clamps down on the IVC. So although your blood pressure is better, your shock is worse because you have less cardiac output. So in that situation, I'll reach for epinephrine because it will increase your cardiac output as well. The second situation in which I would use epinephrine first is maybe the septic shock patient who has a horrible-looking heart. maybe they have an EF of 10 or 15%, I'll either do Levofed and Dobutamine, or I'll just use epinephrine.
And I think those are great times to reach for the epi. the only other time I'd really reach for it is in that rare situation where you have somebody who's bradycardic and hypotensive.
Yeah.
So if their heart rate's low, you can make a strong case for adding epi. It's going to increase their heart rate, increase their systemic vascular resistance, and stabilize them pretty quickly.
Agreed. Or anaphylactic shock.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Any time that you would reach for dobutamine is the first-line presser.
No, not really. So maybe in cardiogenic shock, if you've got somebody who's really, really bad and not responding to positive pressure ventilation, you know, they're really tenuous and you're nervous about putting them on a nitro drip, you could consider throwing dobutamine on board, but I would have norepinephrine on standby too. Because of the vasodilatory effects of dobutamine, you can see a drop in blood pressure and it could potentially lead to a non-perfusing state.
Yeah, so. Dobutamine and milrinone are not pressors, they're inotropes, and so if somebody has a normal blood pressure and a bad-looking heart, maybe you could do those primarily, but if you are, let's say you have a big MI, you're in cardiogenic shock, I would do a pressor first and an inotrope in addition.
Absolutely.
All right, and then the last one, are we spitting in the wind and just stacking up our healthcare debt by throwing vasopressin in there? Or are we just throwing it in too late like we used to do with Levofed? Levofed used to be called Leave 'em Dead because it was the last one that we would put on. We're like, well, they're going to die. I might as well throw Levofed on there. We found out Levofed, actually, when you throw it in right away, really helpful. And I know there's some studies that they're trying to look about throwing vasopressin on earlier. I don't know if that's the people that make it or not, but any thought about vasopressin?
It's a good question. So I have a couple situations in which I guess let me comment on vasopressin first. So they have done head-to-head trials with vasopressin and norepinephrine, and what they have found is you don't get more MIs if you use vasopressin, but you don't improve mortality either. The only thing you do is you decrease the amount of Levofed that you're going to use. So I think vasopressin is a good second presser for all-comer septic shock or any kind of shock. If you need a second presser, vasopressin is a good choice. I will start it automatically on somebody that I think is chronically endogenously depleted. So the liver failure patient is a good example. If somebody comes in with liver failure and they're in septic shock from they got a pneumonia or SPP, I will just add vasopressin no matter how much Levo I'm on and try to come down off the Levo first. What do you think?
I agree. I think it's a good second line choice, particularly in septic shock. You know, if you think about it, when you start getting to your max doses of norepinephrine, your alpha receptors are going to be saturated. So I think adding vasopressin and getting vasoconstriction from a different site of action is a reasonable approach. It's not supported by literature, but I don't know if it's a matter of not having the evidence out there or if it's a matter of, you know, it doesn't work. It's hard to say without the evidence to back it up, but I think physiologically it makes sense.
Yeah. So. What do you do when you have this situation? So somebody's on 50 of Levofed, they're on vasopressin, still hypotensive, people are thinking about a third presser, they start talking about adding dopamine or adding phenylephrine, maybe they're on dobutamine. What's your recommendation?
I think the patient's not going to leave the ER.
Yeah, it's not a good sign. So I'll usually add steroids at that point. I'll start thinking about adding steroids, but that's not going to have an immediate benefit. And then, you know, if you go with the surviving sepsis guidelines, they recommend adding epi. It's not a situation that I've encountered very often. Usually I can get them under control with just norepi and vasopressin, and then your colleagues up on MICU come down and grab them. So it's not something that I see very frequently, but I think epinephrine would definitely be at the forefront of my mind.
Steroids is a good thought. What I usually do is if I'm reaching for my second presser, I send a random cortisol, and I give a dose of steroids. And the only reason I send a random cortisol is so I know if I can continue it or not.
Right.
But I'll give them a dose of steroids. And then the epi thing, I do this all the time. If they're going for a third presser, it's usually switching to epi.
That makes sense.
I've seen it before where people are on 4 or 5 vasoactive drugs, and then you give epi, and all of a sudden their heart rate comes down, blood pressure goes up, and it's just the epi that they needed. So what I do to test it is I'll give 100. If they're on 3 pressers, I'll give 100 mics of epi and see what their blood pressure does. If they respond to it well, then I'll switch them to epi. If they don't, then I'll move on to something else.
Now, when you do that push-dose epi, do you just use the pre-filled syringe that you find in the code card, or do you do a serial dilution with that?
Good question. So if I'm doing it for push-dose for somebody that I've just intubated or whatever, I usually, to be honest, I just do it out of the code dose, and I'll give a half an ml and then flush it with a bunch of saline.
Okay.
But the way you should do it is serial dilutions.
So for the serial dilution would be taking 1 ml of the 1 to 10,000 out of the prefilled syringe.
That's the code dose.
The code dose, and then adding that to 9 mL of saline to give you a 1 to 100,000 concentration, which might be a little bit better when given IV, but. Again, we're definitely in the realm of speculation here. There's not a lot of evidence for any of this stuff. So
yeah, I would recommend if you're going to be doing push dose epi, you should dilute it out.
Agreed.
What do you think, Aaron?
I think you people are a whole lot smarter than I am. But I'm going to try to summarize all of the important and very poignant things that Jared and Chris said. First off, norepinephrine is pretty much our go-to pressor. Now, you have to know how it works in order to use it so that you know inappropriate times to use norepinephrine, like anaphylaxis or somebody that's hypovolemic that actually needs volume back. But it's usually a good choice, and I think Jared and Chris highlighted on some points of where that's a good option. Epinephrine is usually your second first choice. So these two medications are probably ones that you want to have the dose right in the forefront of your cranium so that you can spat them off when the nurse is setting up your drip. Jared also recanted, except for a couple situations, his all-time push dose pressors that he was so famous for several years ago. Thankfully, that was not recorded, however this was. So maybe in a couple years when push dose pressors is back in vogue, we'll have to recant this podcast. So Jared, I'm a patient in the emergency department and you come in and say, "Hi sir, how are you doing today?" And I simultaneously spew blood out of my mouth and rectum. Both of us are about to have a bad day. So let's talk real quick about the management of upper GI bleeds and lower GI bleed. I used to get really nervous sending people home if I didn't figure out why they were bleeding. Someone comes in, they were vomiting up blood or they had blood in their stool and they were guaiac positive. And you kind of go, yeah, I guess you do. You actually have blood coming out that's supposed to be staying in. At what point do you feel comfortable sending patients home? We'll start with the easiest and we'll end with the most difficult.
Okay, well, you know, I guess maybe we need to make sure we're talking about the same thing because there's GI bleed and then there's GI bleed. So if it's, I've been vomiting for the last few days and today I had a little blood in it and I have a history of ulcer disease or something. And you don't see any bloody emesis while they're in the emergency department. Or let's say it's a lower GI bleed. They say, "I have blood in my stool." And they're guaiac positive, but you check out hemoglobin, and their hemoglobin's fine, and their RDW is fine. They're not making new red cells. And you check it again in a few hours, and it's the same. Then that person is not going to bleed to death. You know, they're more than likely not going to bleed to death.
So let's step it up a little bit. Let's say that someone comes in and they say, "I've been throwing up handfuls of blood for the past day." Now what are you thinking about this person?
Well, that's a little more ominous. So that's more likely to be something like gastritis or a bleeding ulcer. If they're vomiting up handfuls of blood over several days, it's probably not a very high pressure bleed. And it may be more ominous because they may have signs of dehydration. If you check a CBC, they may have a high RDW, meaning that they're making new red cells. But if their hemoglobin is okay, even with a high RDW, I might treat their nausea and have them get scoped as an outpatient,
okay,
depending on how quickly they can be scoped.
What about you have a patient that comes in and says, "Yeah, I've been having black tarry stools," and you go to check their shorts. You don't even need to put the finger in because you see melena in their pants.
Mm-hmm.
How does that differ from a patient that's maybe got a positive guaiac?
Are they old or young?
Let's say that they are 50.
50 would be in the bleeding diverticulum category as the most likely etiology. So that person should probably stay because if they have a bleeding diverticulum, they might be eroding or invading an artery.
Yeah, melena for me and handfuls of blood is usually where I start to draw the line of you're probably not going to go home. That makes me nervous. That's a fair amount of blood to put out. When you've got melena that's actually leaking out, I tend to be a little more concerned. And especially in the older, not that 50 is old, but as you start to get older, that makes me a lot more concerned.
If you're bleeding so much that you're coagulating that blood, they probably shouldn't go home.
Yeah, agreed. So the next step up from that is the person that is either having such a brisk GI bleed that it's lower coming out bright red, or it's upper and they can't even tell you they're having a GI bleed because all they can tell you is, I'm going to do that noise a couple more times. So your management priorities for someone like this.
Yeah, well, both of them can be incredibly frustrating for different reasons. So
let's take the upper first so that we're not going back and forth too much.
Okay, so upper, we're really talking the massive upper GI bleeder. So the first issue with them is, are they protecting their airway? And the answer is, if it's that brisk of an airway that they have, or that brisk of a GI bleeder, let's say it's a bleeding ulcer, Dulafoy lesion, or
the
a variceal bleed.
Can you use it in a sentence? Now, a medical condition characterized by a large, tortuous arterial in the stomach wall that erodes and bleeds. It can cause gastric hemorrhage. It is difficult to diagnose, as the lesion is difficult to find on endoscopy, but is usually suspected clinically due to a pattern of intermittent, often large-volume, GI bleeds. Dulafoy lesion. D-I-E-U-L-A-F-O-Y. Dulafoy.
That's under such high pressure and high volume that the answer is they are likely not protecting their airway and probably aspirating. So the first issue in management with them is you have to protect their airway. How do you do that? Well, most of the time, if they're exsanguinating, then that's you're limited to a blind procedure kind of thing. If they're not exsanguinating, they're just a massive bleed. The way I differentiate that is exsanguinating is they're going to bleed to death in the next hour or so. Then you could probably lay them down, and if you use DL or video laryngoscope, whatever, then you could probably stay above the blood and put a yank hour in the esophagus, let it suction. There's a debate about paralysis versus no paralysis. I'm in the no paralysis camp. We could talk about that some other time. And you secure the airway. The second thing you need to do, or concomitantly, you need to have large IV access. And there's a propensity, I think, to put in a cordis, but I really think if you just had two big peripheral IVs, you could probably resuscitate them adequately. Interestingly, the liver patients who have a bleeding varix, it's usually not the coagulopathy that kills them, it's the high pressure that kills them. So their INR and everything is always prolonged, but one thing that's always bothered me is why do people who have cirrhosis, if they're that auto-anticoagulated, why do they have portal vein thromboses? It doesn't make sense, right? So I started looking into this, and it turns out that the INR is normalized to normal people. And so if you were to take a cirrhotic patient's serum or plasma and you run the INR test, it's going to be prolonged. But that doesn't mean that they are auto-anticoagulated, because although their vitamin K-dependent factors might be diminished, their von Willebrand factor and factor 8 or whatever could be 200 to 300% super normal. So they could easily be in the clotting phase of things and get portal vein thromboses rather than the bleeding phase. So I forgot where I was going with this. But
I've actually run into that in the past with liver patients in the surgical trauma ICU that developed a DVT or a PE, and we said, well, we need to put them on heparin. And the argument was, well, but their INR is 2.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but they're not actually anticoagulated, back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. So the point I think you're trying to get at is that, they are still, just because they're bleeding so much, the first thing to give is not platelets.
Right, it doesn't mean
not
quite
FFP. Yeah, they don't need to be, they don't necessarily need prothrombin complex concentrate.
Correct.
They need blood.
Correct, yeah, and they need PRBCs. Mm-hmm. They don't need massive transfusion type stuff, because the reality is that most of them are probably hyperfibrinolytic and need Amicar or tranexamic acid. That's one question that we're trying to answer. But if you look at liver transplant patients who are bleeding and whatnot in the operating room and they do TEGs on them, they're usually hyperfibrinolytic. So There was an article that came out last year in the New England Journal of Medicine that looked at transfusion thresholds for these GI bleeders. And granted, they excluded the patient that's exsanguinating. But if you have just a brisk upper GI bleed, you can usually let them bleed down pretty low before you have to give them blood back. Now, I will say, though, that if you start pounding them with liters and liters of saline, you will make them coagulopathic at some point. So I think I like to resuscitate people in this situation with blood products, but I think that it's probably not necessary.
So let's go then to the lower GI bleed, the brisk lower GI bleed that is actually making such a fast transit time that it's coming out bright red. There's a debate of, and I've seen this happen a couple times in the ER, do they go to the medical ICU for GI? Do they go to the surgical ICU? Or do they just go to the OR? I've seen tagged red blood cell scans. I've seen all kinds of craziness to try to figure out what needs to happen. But the question is does it need to be scoped or does it need to be excised?
Well, when you're talking about lower GI bleed, there's a lot more surface area to bleed to death from. So the question is, where is it coming from? So the first thing you want to make sure is it a upper GI bleed that is bleeding so quickly that it's a cathartic and it's going straight through the bowel and it's coming out bright red? So, you know, put in an NG tube and do a lavage and see if that comes out bloody. If it comes out bloody, it's an upper GI bleed. They need an upper endoscopy. If it's not, you've ruled out a gastric or proximal duodenal lesion that's bleeding that quickly. Then you need to know, in my 30-something feet of bowel, or however many feet of bowel people have, where is this bleed coming from? And that is incredibly frustrating. So it comes down to, what, you're laughing?
I'm laughing at 30 feet of bowel. I think it's like 12,
yeah, isn't whatever.
It? Yeah, 30. There are probably a couple people I know that have 30 feet of bowel. They've been on too many narcs, and they've just stretched it out to twice its size. Sorry, keep going.
So you got to figure out, where is it coming from? And people think that the answer is, well, let's get GI to come in and do a colonoscopy. If it's an 80-year-old person, then the likelihood is that the older they are, the more likely it is to be a ruptured AVM or a bleeding diverticulum. So can GI scope them? Well, keep in mind, that's a really small camera, and if it's that much blood, it's just all they're going to see is blood. And so they say, well, you know, resuscitate them, stabilize them, and we'll scope them later. There are data that say that they don't need to be scoped in the first 6 hours. It doesn't change mortality and whatnot. The bigger question is probably to find out where it's coming from with interventional radiology. So they go to IR, they get an angio, and if they see something that they can embolize, they embolize it. But I would say half the time they don't see anything that they can embolize. And then you get a tag cell scan. So the tag cell scan is, you know, rarely positive for anything. If it is something, it'll say, you know, there's bleeding in the right lower quadrant, and then they have to go do another endoscopy, or by this time you've stabilized them, they get a colonoscopy. So I would say the place to start is probably with IR. Okay. If they're exsanguinating, they probably should go to the operating room.
Okay, good. So let's go back to upper GI bleeds real quickly. So you've got somebody that's got an upper GI bleed. You've managed the airway. You suspect it's variceal, but you're not quite sure if it's actually gastric. Do you do a PPI? Do you do octreotide, or do you do both?
Well, I think there's no harm in doing both at first. I mean, you definitely do the PPI because you want to limit acid production. And in terms of octreotide, if they have risk of high portal pressures, then you can give the octreotide, or you should give the octreotide. We can always stop it later. Interestingly about octreotide, though, is, you know, we give octreotide for 5 days to try to drop portal pressure, but there was a study in rats where they put transducers in the portal system and they gave octreotide, and it didn't matter if they gave a bolus drip, didn't matter, the portal pressure drop only lasted about 5 minutes.
Interesting. Very cool. Now what about the NG tube debate? Put the NG tube down, you got to see where it is, you got to get the blood out, or don't you dare traumatize those fragile little varices and you're going to cause the bleed to be even worse.
If they're bleeding to death and you need the suction in order to get an airway, I would say put in the NG tube. If you can avoid putting in the NG tube, I would avoid putting in the NG tube.
Okay. Fair enough.
you want to run us through real quickly. You put down the ET tube, blood is still pooling up out of the mouth, and you've got to grab for that giant Minnesota tube. I know we had one at South Campus within the last 6 months that Vivian Ng had to put in, and she kind of went through it with everybody. Can you talk real quick about not only when do you start looking for that giant tube, but also what the different balloons are going to do?
Yeah, so if they're, you know, if they're bleeding to death and you need to stop the bleeding. If it's bleeding too much, obviously GI can't scope them. So the thought is put down a Blakemore tube, put down a Minnesota tube, see if you can get it to stop. And if you can get it to stop, then GI can go scope them later once they're more stabilized. Oftentimes GI will try to scope them, not see anything, and then say, let's put down the Minnesota tube. So the way I do it is, and it's a little more complicated because if you actually pull out the insert package and you look at the instructions, the units of pressure are not equivalent to what we measure, so you got to do some conversion, but here's how I do it. So I put the Minnesota tube down, and there's the big gastric balloon, and then there's the long, I think it's a high pressure, low volume esophageal balloon, and they have different ports, and then each one has a suction port. So you got to get the Christmas tree to put into each of the ports, and then you hook it up with a lure lock so you can maintain pressure in there. So you put the thing down, and I usually put in, you know, 50 cc's or 100 cc's of saline. And the reason I use saline instead of air is because if you think about it, it's high pressure and you have disrupted mucosa. So now let's say that balloon ruptures, and it's venous, right? So the balloon ruptures, and you get a big air embolism, theoretically. So I use saline because if it ruptures, then there's no big deal. You just have saline. So 50 cc's of saline and or 100 cc's, whatever you'd like. Make sure that it slides back and forth pretty easily. Get a chest x-ray and make sure that it's actually in the stomach. Once you're sure that it's in the stomach, then you inflate it more. And you can put like 500 cc's in there. But I usually don't need to put in more than like 250. So you put in 250 and then you need to put tension on it. So pull it back to the gastroesophageal junction. And once you have it there, then you can suck from the esophageal suction and see if you're getting blood. If you're getting a bunch of blood, then you need to blow up the esophageal balloon. And the esophageal balloon is the one where you really need to pay attention to how much pressure you have with a manometer. But to be honest, you rarely need to blow up the esophageal balloon because when you tamponade on at the gastroesophageal junction, it usually works pretty well. So you want to keep the tension on there, and then like every 4 hours, you need to release the tension for about 30 minutes so you don't get ischemic mucosa.
Very cool. All right, so GI bleeds, when they come in and they're bad, when they're hypotensive, it's great to have an algorithm to go by on these guys. And usually what I'll do, always your cardiac airway breathing, IVO2 monitor, gives the nurses and medics something to do while you're trying to figure out what your next steps are going to be. Always make sure that you get a type and screen. Always make sure that you get your H&H so that you can see how far behind you are. And remember that you're not always going to see that initial H&H drop depending on when the GI bleed started. You can lose a lot of blood and not really show it on your H&H initially. The other thing you want to make sure to get is your coags. And then, like Jared mentioned, some kind of a PPI, whether it's a bolus or a drip, that you're going to be starting. One or the other, try to get the acid production down, and then think about octreotide if they've got liver issues that you're trying to prevent from the variceal bleeds. Other than that, it's basic patient management. Try to keep them resuscitated as best as possible. But it's important to remember, it's something we don't always check off all the time, but get that type and screen because they're probably going to need blood later.
Yeah, there's another situation that I know we've mentioned on this podcast before a few months ago, but the patient that comes in that says, I've been vomiting up blood, and you check their hemoglobin and it's 3 or 2. How do you manage that? You know, they then unleash fury and start yakking up a bunch of blood. The odds are that they probably already have high output heart failure. And if you have to intubate them and you transition them to positive pressure ventilation, and you're going to take away their oxygen delivery, and it's not going to go very well for you. Same thing as like the little old lady who has a slow GI bleed and has a hemoglobin of 3. You know, usually if you check a BNP, it's pretty high, and they probably have high output heart failure, and you got to transfuse them up fairly slowly.
So the basic ones, the ones that come in bleeding and are more at like an H&H of 6 and 22, or that are maybe a little bit hypotensive, or maybe are perfectly normotensive and are doing great but are having a consistent upper GI bleed, these are the good ones to practice on and to develop your approach, develop your gestalt, so that when you do have one of the truly bad ones, you know, this is different. I need to go past what I normally do. So practice makes perfect. Thanks, Jared.
Yeah, one last thing, though. The variceal bleeder, you don't really want to transfuse them up above a hemoglobin of around 9. The reason being that you'll just create congestion in the portal veins or the portal vasculature, and you can end up rupturing another one.
Good to know. Thanks, man. Stop it out when they bring that chorus in. I bleed it out, digging deeper just to throw it away. So we were going to do EMTALA stuff this month, but instead, one of our interns asked about doing something regarding charting and patient flow efficiency. Those of you that are interns, do you remember in July how new and exciting this new world was? Terrifying, and you know, you were really excited for both of those patients you saw during your shift that you actually helped them. Well, you've got new interns that are coming in July, and now you're going to be expected to be the workhorse. This is usually a good time for you as interns to start pushing yourselves a little bit more than you're comfortable, because you have juniors and you have seniors that are there to get your back. That doesn't mean the juniors and seniors completely skip out. Well, sometimes it does. But that means that if you get in over your head, you have someone to fall back on, because I guarantee in July, there's going to be a lot of people to be seen, a lot of stuff to be done, and you won't have this kind of help then. So good time to start pushing yourself now. Juniors, you get to start maybe backing off a little bit and doing more of the supervisory role, which you're going to be doing next year as well. You're going to have to supervise medical students. You're going to have to help see what the entire flow of the ED is going to be like, in preparation for when you go out. Seniors, you don't have to worry about this. You don't have to worry about new interns coming on, because you're going to be the new intern wherever you go to get a real job. You're going to be the first year attending out, and you are going to find that they're going to expect you to see a whole lot more patients. You're also going to see that it's a little bit easier when you don't have to check every patient with your attending, or maybe it's harder because you spend extra time going, did I do the right thing? Is this the right decision? So we're going to talk a little bit about efficiency, how to get your patients in and out so that you can see the next patient and make sure that everybody is well taken care of while you're trying to do this. So Jared, what was the transition like for you when you went from senior resident to attending as far as your patient flow and your efficiency?
Well, it took a hit for sure at the beginning, because you aren't sure how much to trust yourself, trust the story that you hear from the resident or the medical student and whatnot. And you have an inclination to go redo everything that they did so that you can make sure that you feel good about it. So as an early attending, it was tough.
For me, I had to figure out what my flow was going to be like, and I figured out finally a good pattern that worked for me, and then we got Epic. So I had to find a whole nother pattern after only about 3 months, and now I'm finally starting to get into the groove of it. But to give you an idea, I see on average about 25 patients a shift. At my busiest, I've seen 40. And I've heard some of the residents say, there's no way I could see that many patients in the system we have right now. And sometimes it is a little bit hard, but that's why I would encourage those of you that are interns or juniors not to try to see 40 patients. But if you know on average how many you see, try to pick up one extra one and try to work on things you can do to get them seen. I don't want anybody pushing themselves to the point at which they're going to hurt somebody. Namely a patient. You know, you may sprain your ankle or something trying to get to that room, but I want you to try to get a little bit more done, and you'll find that you become more efficient by necessity.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
So for those of you that are junior residents, managing a medical student can be, I think House of God said, if you give me a medical student that only triples my work, I'll kiss his feet. there are medical students that are tremendously helpful, that know what they can do to be helpful, that are geared towards EM, and those are wonderful. And then there are medical students that don't want to do emergency medicine, but they realize it's important to get a little experience. And you need to, one of the things that's helped me supervising medical students is to find out, what do you want out of this rotation? What do you want out of this shift? What kind of patients do you want to see? What are you interested in going into? And how can I teach you towards that and keep you interested? If you keep them interested, they'll keep working.
Yeah, one thing that I learned was that if you tell the medical student, why don't you go see this chest painter and then come tell me about it, and then I'll go see the chest painter after you, and then we'll go tell the attending, that delays the care by a while. So one thing that I would recommend is, you know, you go see the patient first, then send them in to see the patient. While they're in there seeing the patient, you can quickly run it by the attending or whatever, and at least have the workup going so that then when they come to tell you about the patient, you both know about it already, and it doesn't delay that care by an hour or two.
And I would always recommend that if you send the medical student to see the patient first, walk by the room, look at the monitor, look at the patient. Although I have been fooled by that before, of a very well-appearing guy with a K of 7.
Yeah.
Interns, you were the ones that asked for this, so let's talk a little bit about how to push yourself more than you ever thought possible. You all will do it. You all will be able to exceed your own expectations. Some of the things that helped me, we talked about this a while ago. Ash Panchal, who was one of our attendings last year, had a great little algorithm for going through this for me. The first thing you do for safety's sake is take care of your sick patients. Go and check on them. Look in, see how are they doing, and then you can move on. Second thing you do, anybody that can be dispoed should be dispoed. So if you've got somebody that's ready to be admitted, go ahead and admit them. If medicine says, I'd like you to wait for the second troponin, you can deal with that as you'd like. But if you've got everything back and you go, you know, patient's ready to be admitted, go ahead and do it. If you've got somebody that's ready to be discharged, go ahead and discharge them. And this doesn't have to take a lot of time. It doesn't need to take 20 minutes to do, but start printing up their paperwork and getting them ready to go. And then check on any labs. Then go see new patients and always make sure that you're keeping an eye on the board. There should never be 15 patients waiting on a room, but the patients that have been here waiting to be admitted or discharged are going to be waiting a lot longer if suddenly you've picked up 9 new patients and you can't dispo any of them.
I'm sure it was the same for both you and me when we went from the end of our intern year where we were thinking, you know what, I'm kind of efficient, I think I'm ready to do this, and all of a sudden you become a junior and the nurses are coming to grab you to say, hey, can you come check out this patient in room 13, they're hypotensive, and then the trauma reg comes in and you got to go see it because the senior's off with the medical student, the intern can't do it, and then you realize, oh my god, this is, it completely derails my progress, right? And all of a sudden you're not efficient anymore. But this is one area where Epic is probably going to make it easier, because I see these wows or cows or whatever they are all over the place, and so when it says trauma red in, you know, 12 minutes or whatever, and everybody goes in there and stands around and chats while they're rooming all these other patients, you could log on to that wow, look at your labs, look at your x-rays for the other patients, see who, you know, everybody has a different opinion on this, but see who's been roomed, and if there's a chest painter and you look at the triage note, it sounds like a pretty typical chest painter, you can order, you can initiate those orders initially. And there are some people that might disagree with that, but the reality is that there are a lot of hospitals that the nurses initiate that stuff at triage. So I personally am not against it. Mm-hmm. I think that it's fine. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
You know, I'm all for that as well. I like, if there's a scenario that I go, you're a 7-year-old that comes in with chest pain, there's no way I'm not going to get an EKG on you. There's no way I'm not going to get a chest x-ray on you. Unless your complaint was I was punched in the chest,
yeah.
Then I kind of get some of that stuff going. And that's good because it helps the flow of the department and the flow of your patients so that people aren't hanging around forever. Another thing I really think is important is to manage your patient's expectations. If they come in and you've got an expectation just from your gestalt, I think this person's probably going to be admitted, it's okay to suggest it. Don't say for certain. You know, because sometimes you get surprised. Your labs or your imaging show up something that's going to sway you differently. But I usually will manage their expectations. If they're belly pain and they don't have peritonitis, I usually say, you know, we're going to look for some of the dangerous stuff. But if we don't find anything, here is the plan so that you can get that out all in one setting. And then when you get all of your lab work back, if it's exactly what you thought, you go in, you go, yep, this is just what we talked about. Let's review your return precautions. I'm going to get you ready to go.
Yeah, one of the things that I always think about is if it's not busy, then efficiency is not an issue, mm-hmm. right? But if it is busy, and I mean overwhelmingly busy, where there's a billion patients in the lobby and whatnot, then your job is to extract information and figure out how to get out of the room once you've extracted that information and, mm-hmm. and get out of the room before you're sucked into something, you know, the 12-minute discussion about somebody's chronic pain history and whatnot. That's what slows you down. Mm-hmm. Do you think that that charting in the room on Epic is improving efficiency or not? I don't do it.
I don't do it either, so I'm a bad person to ask. I think if it works well for you, keep doing it. If it doesn't work well for you, try something different. You can always try to improve your efficiency a little bit. One of the things that helps me with both my time in the room with the patient and my charting is I have a standardized review of systems and a standardized physical exam that I do for both my high acuity and my low acuity patients. If you come in and you got an ankle sprain, I'm not going to ask you all 10 review of systems because I know that you're not going to be billed at a level 5. So instead, I ask my standard review of systems that are more important for me from a taking care of the patient standpoint. Yeah, you sprained your ankle, but you know, have you been having vomiting, diarrhea, fevers, other things that would point me in the direction that maybe something else is going on? And the same with my physical exam. I do the same physical exam on every patient with a couple of highlights if you've got something different. If you're a headache patient, I'm going to do a full neuro exam, and I know exactly how I document that. Those of you that love the macros on Epic, that's great as long as you remember that you're responsible for what you put down. If you go in and didn't do all of these things and you put it down because that's your macro, that's not good. It's dangerous. So get your macro to where it's exactly what you do for, I have two of them, high acuity, low acuity. My high acuity ones are my abdominal pains, my traumas, anybody that's being admitted, and I do the full 10 review of systems, the same ones every time. And same for my physical exam.
Yeah, I think the biggest piece of advice I could give is to be adaptable. We get so focused on how many new red X's there are on the board that we don't take a step back and look at the global department as a whole. And, you know, if you have one of those days as a junior or a senior where you have 12 trauma reds or trauma whites that come in, the depletion to your efficiency is different than those days where you have 40 patients that get roomed at one time, which is also different than the days where you intubate 6 patients or once or whatever. The depletion to your efficiency needs to be adaptable, or your solution to that needs to be adaptable.
I think that it's important to remember, as a junior, you're going to be seeing more patients, and you're probably going to be seeing higher acuity patients, sometimes just by accident. You sign up for chest pain after chest pain after chest pain. Suddenly, one of them is in third-degree heart block and needs a transvenous pacer. So your volume is actually going to help your not only your experience of getting to do cool stuff, but it's going to help all in all with your efficiency because you've picked up chest pain after chest pain after chest pain, and you start to develop a nice flow through it of this is what I usually do for chest pain, but I always want to check with a couple extra questions. Is this one of the rare things like an aortic dissection, or is this a subtle PE or something like that? I think that it's fine if you pick up the sickest patient in the emergency department to explain to people afterwards, I'm very sorry that you had to wait. I had a very ill patient. Most people are very good about that. So I felt bad that there are all these red X's and I've been in a critical patient's room for 45 minutes. You can't feel bad about that because you were doing what we are trained to do. However, once you're done, they're stabilized, you go on to the ankle sprain.
You just said something that was a very good point. And that is that you want to ask a couple of extra questions to make sure it's not the bad thing. So this is a particularly dangerous time for the interns in that they've seen enough patients to realize that most of them don't have anything, but they haven't seen enough of them yet to realize that one of them's going to screw you. Mm-hmm. And so you have to be cognizant of the rut. And there are certain chief complaints that are dangerous for that. Back pain is probably the worst. Mm-hmm. You see back pain all day, and most back pains are nothing. But there's that one back pain just based on chance alone by the numbers of patients with back pain that we have that is going to have something bad.
Yeah. So All in all, now's a good time to start pushing yourself if you haven't already. If you normally see 6 patients a shift, try to see 8. If you normally see 8 patients a shift, try to see 9 or 10. You don't have to push yourself immediately to 25. In fact, because we are pretty well staffed, we usually don't have the numbers for everybody to be seeing 25 or 30 patients. But I guarantee you there will be those days, or better put, those nights, where it's just a quick-paced night and you can really start getting patients going. North Pod is a great time for you to work on your efficiency, because a lot of these patients can be discharged without a whole lot of workup. So how do I get my efficiency up in North Pod? I do a little bit of managing the expectations. I go and grab the nurse and say, will you PO challenge this patient? Or better yet, I go get the popsicle myself and I start printing up the discharge paperwork before I present. And if my attending wants to change their mind and they want to do something different, that's fine. But it's helpful to get your efficiency going.
Yeah, agreed.
So I hope you guys can take this in the manner in which it was intended. Every month we do a section on documentation, on billing, on efficiency, on things that probably drive you crazy because you go, how am I supposed to get all this stuff done? Am I supposed to chart first? Am I supposed to see new patients? I get different messages depending on who I talk to. This is why it's a 3-year program, and we're hoping that little by little you're able to incorporate this stuff into your practice so that when you're done with residency, you can go forth and get the job of your dreams and become happy, productive members of society. Specifically, happy emergency doctors that actually enjoy their job. Speaking of becoming happy emergency physicians that actually love their job, we talked to the Peter Rosen.
Don't act like you're not impressed.
And I only had time for one question, which was good because his answer was a lot to digest.
So, Peter, I heard you speak about a year or so ago about something I wanted to ask you a bit more about. You said that you don't mind taking care of drug-seeking patients. You don't mind taking care of patients that are malingering. But you have the thing that really gets you down is the somatizers, the people who come in and they can't separate their emotional or social issues from their physical pain. Do you remember kind of that discussion that you had?
Yes, I was talking about how to survive in emergency medicine over time, and that one of the key tasks is to identify the patients you hate and figure out how to take care of them, because you can't escape them. And for me, the group that has given me the most frustration and trouble are the somatizers. And I guess as I learned how to take care of them, I began to figure out why it is that they frustrated me so much and made me so angry. And the reason is that they really defy all of the missions of medicine, that if we can summarize them: cure disease when possible, alleviate it when possible, and give comfort. Well, I suppose the third is still part of taking care of a somatizer, but they need a different kind of comfort, and I think until I realized what it was, that was partially where the frustration was coming from. I think you have to separate somatizers from patients who have addiction and from patients who have chronic pain syndromes, because I think that the management of those patients is quite different, and the problem is a quite different one. We tend to get angry with the addictive patient because they want us to do things that we aren't prepared to do, such as give them large quantities of addictive drugs. And it's hard to know what they do with those drugs. Nobody needs 800 tablets of Vicodin. So my guess is they probably keep enough of them to keep their opiate level where they're comfortable and sell the rest. But whatever they do with it, it doesn't matter, because the secret to their management is to not enter their delusional system. And don't think you have to fight with them. You don't make it a clash of egos. You make it a rule-driven process that you are subject to just as much as they are. In other words, You don't care how much Vicodin they get, but the people who make the rules do, and you have to live under them just as much as they do.
It's not me. It's unknown entity upstairs.
It's them. Yeah. Okay. And that way it takes it away from me versus you, and I'm not giving you what you need from me. So that diffuses the anger and a lot of the hostility. The patients with chronic pain syndromes have a different problem. They frequently have a disease that started the pain that has either been taken care of or is not capable of being taken care of, and they're going to continue to have pain. And the problem with those patients is that who knows how to define pain? It's different for everybody. It's probably different within an individual depending upon what you do. You well know that when you're distracted that you are basically anesthetic to large parts of your body. So similarly with pain, the more you focus on it, the more it bothers you, and the more you ignore it, the more it is something that you can live with. And as you get older, you seem to be less bothered by pain, perhaps because you've had so much in your life, or because perhaps you just get used to it and it doesn't bother you so much. But those are different problems. Now, the somatizer, I don't truly understand. I find that it may be part of the psychiatric syndrome known as conversion reaction, whatever that is caused by. And there doesn't seem to be much help in the psychiatric literature as to what causes it, how to identify it, or how to treat it. And I think that's the problem with the somatizer, is that one way to recognize it is when the patient complains of a series of signs and symptoms that is so unfamiliar that it doesn't immediately suggest a disease to you. When you are a young physician, almost every patient is like that. Until you begin to experience enough disease entities that you can recognize a variety of presentations. But after you've been around the track a few times, when you have a patient who presents with a complex of signs and symptoms that to you is unrecognizable, think somatizing. Now, why do they develop this? I simply have never been able to fathom. I've read a fair bit about some of the somatizing diseases like fibromyalgia. My favorite paper on fibromyalgia was called "Fibromyalgia, Is It the Real Thing?" And it proceeds to describe an entity that has no consistent signs and symptoms, that has no objective physical findings, that has no identifiable imaging studies or laboratory tests, and that has no consistent therapy, and then concludes it's the real thing. And to me, that's nonsense. If you don't have those things, how can it possibly be a disease? And then when you look at the patients who present with it, what you discover is similar to the patient with a conversion reaction. There's a great deal of secondary gain going on through the illness. That patient is more than likely manipulating family members, co-workers, the people with whom that patient has to interact. And that probably has something to do with why there is a need to be chronically ill. And so the aim of the patient has to be understood if you're going to do anything for providing the comfort that you would like to give to a patient. And the aim of the somatizer is to be sick as often and as prolonged and in as difficult fashion as possible. The natural history is that there are frequent presentations which increase in number during vacation and during holidays and during other times of family gatherings. There is a clear use of multiple physicians. There is a clear need to have multiple hospitalizations, extensive and expensive workups, and a total befuddlement of the medical staffs who cannot, quote, ever find the answer or help me. There is, in combination with this, often total inability to accept common pain relievers. There is an unbelievable incidence of allergies to every pain medicine, which I find understandable only when I put it into the equation of the patient wants to be ill rather than well. So I think that the first goal of medicine is unmeetable in this patient. They don't have a disease that's recognizable, they don't have a disease that's curable, and they don't have a disease that's treatable. So what do they want? They, in fact, want to be told they have a problem that's not fixable. And that goes against everything that we learn how to do and why we're taught our mission is to be. But until you find that, there's no way to deal with these patients. So I generally approach the somatizer with, you have big problems, and they nod. And I say, you've seen multiple physicians, and they nod and give you an incredible number. And none of them have ever been able to identify or fix your problems, and they nod. And so then I invoke the stupidity law, which is, I'm just a stupid emergency physician. Compared to those doctors that you've seen, I don't know anything. There's no possible way I'm going to be able to solve your problems. But nevertheless, how can I help you get through the day? And usually that's all that's necessary. I've had several somatizers who'd come to the emergency department only when I was on duty, simply because they liked interacting with me because I told them that they had unfixable problems and they just needed to talk about their problems for 10 or 15 minutes and that was fine. So once I learned how to do that, I became much less hostile to them and much less frustrated by them. And I think that the difficulty is in recognizing who has a chronic disease and who has a somatizing syndrome. Now, there are patients who have chronic diseases that overlap with chronic pain syndrome, such as patients with relapsing pancreatitis. And they often don't carry the laboratory tests, abnormalities that you would think would be associated with a flare-up of the disease. Those patients are difficult, but they probably have organic pathology. And if you could figure out how to get rid of that pancreas, and there are surgical extirpations that have been tried for some of these patients with some degree of success, then maybe they can be handled differently. There are other patients who have other named diseases, such as functional bowel disease. And nobody really can predict how the somatizer is going to focalize their individual disease. Some do it with GI, some do it with musculoskeletal, some do it with general affect, the chronic fatigue syndrome. Some do it with urinary problems, frequent urination and burning with urination with completely normal urines when they're examined. Another clue to a somatizer is that if there's a chat room on the internet, they probably have a somatizing syndrome. But I think that the incidence of somatization is high. I would estimate it at maybe 20% of the total ED population, which means you cannot get through a life of emergency medicine without having to interact with these patients. I think it's a mistake to assume that they're depressed and to invoke psychiatry, because I don't think they are depressed. I think they have a totally different problem. Now, that's not to say there aren't depressed patients who don't know they're depressed and who present with physical symptoms as opposed to concerns about their well-being or their feelings of depression. And that needs to be searched for, too. But I do not think that the somatizer is depressed, and I don't think psychiatry can offer them much of anything more than what I've already discussed. I think the second caveat is don't start another workup on these patients. Because once you do, you don't know where to stop. Every review of systems will give you 100% positives. And then how far are you going to investigate? How many sets of enzymes? what imaging studies that they haven't already had 400 times. And the last caveat is that even the somatizers get ill. So that one of the things that you do have to at least do quickly is listen to what they're saying about their symptoms. If they begin to add up to something that you recognize, then maybe you're dealing with a somatizer who actually has a problem like appendicitis. And that can certainly be difficult because the chances are you won't recognize it until after it's perforated. So having said that, I would guess that 95% of your encounters will work with just what can I do for you today? You have real problems, I can't fix them. And then the other 5% fall into those, the somatizer actually getting ill, or it's a combination of somatic disease with something else.
So like I said at the beginning, very fun, very cool stuff. I had a lot of fun doing a lot of these segments that we did. We've come a long way from just Jared and I talking. Actually, we haven't. We're just inviting more people. But we're trying to incorporate some segments. We're trying to do something a little bit more on a regular basis. And again, as always, we appreciate any ideas that you have. That's why we incorporated the efficiency ideas, because someone emailed that they would like to talk about that. So if there's anything else you'd like to talk to, if you'd like to be on an episode of AZMcast, I have no idea why, please email me and let me know what you want to talk about. This podcast is here for our EM residents, our EM faculty, and our EM nurses. So if you have any ideas of how we can make our department better through maybe this little medium, please let me know. And on more of a technical note, if there's anything that I can do differently with the actual recording, let me know. This was a little rough this last time because we were experimenting with different microphones, and I'm sorry that my voice is very loud, Jared's is very soft. But if you have other things that you don't like, the music is too loud, the music is too awful, you can actually hear the paleness of my skin over the microphone, let me know, because we're trying to make it to where it's at least palatable so that you can get some good information through it. So happy April to everybody, and we'll see you again in May.